following is a Dead Bug Podcast. Our memories are like scars. And just like those scars represent a roadmap to the life that has been lived. And the deeper the scar, just like the deeper the memory, they are unlikely to fade. Now 37-year-old Rebecca Thompson, better known to her friends as Becky, she had scars. She had memories. Recently divorced, now raising a 2-year-old daughter on her own. Almost bankrupt. But things had been picking up for Becky. She'd got a new boyfriend. She even decided to bring him to Casper, Wyoming, where she was raised. Where she had those memories. Where she had those scars. Showing him the sights.
The sounds.
And while on this tour, she insisted that they visit a bridge 35 miles out of town. A well-known beauty spot. Her boyfriend, her 2-year-old daughter, and herself stood on the bridge looking over. And as her boyfriend prepared to leave and put the child back in the car, Becky turned to them with a slight smile on her face and a tear in her eye and said, "I love you." And then she jumped.
In this world, there are things that go beyond our understanding. Things that our tiny minds cannot possibly comprehend.
Like, where
does reality end and dreams begin?
Between the flick of a light switch and a dream,
we continually shroud ourselves in a veil of illusion.
It was Monday afternoon, around 4:30, that Mrs. Burridge sent her 2 daughters out to the convenience store to get milk and bread. The oldest always jumped at the opportunity to take the family car for a spin. The oldest being Becky, her daughter from her first marriage. And Becky's 11-year-old half-sister, Amy. Giving Becky the keys to the family car, the 2 girls set out to the convenience store, which was about 10 minutes away. Arriving at the store, they shopped from a list that their mother had written. But little did Becky and Amy know that they were being watched. And when they came out of the shop, the tire was flat. But 2 kindly men offered them a ride home. 11-year-old Amy had called her mother from a payphone and said that 2 nice men had offered to drive them home. But it was the last ride that the 11-year-old would ever take. Because although the sisters refused the ride, they were forced at knife point by the 2 men into a car, where they were driven 35 miles away. And as they did so, the sisters begged and pleaded. Once at the bridge, the 2 men told the girls that they were going to fuck them. But Becky begged them not to rape her younger sister. And they finally agreed. And as they pulled Amy away, Amy said to her sister, "I love you." And they threw her over the bridge. And she fell 110 feet headfirst onto the rocks, dying instantly. Then the 2 men proceeded to rape Becky, taking turns on her for the next 30 minutes. And as she cried and pleaded, they made her go down on them one more time. Then laughed and joked that she was going to join her sister. And by Becky's own account, both men were weak, and as she fought them, they struggled. But they eventually won that struggle, and they threw her over to a 110-foot drop. But what the 2 weak hillbilly rapists hadn't expected was that she hit the side of the canyon on the way down, broke her hip, but also broke her fall. And she landed in the water instead of the rocks. With her hip broken, she swam to the shore and hid in the reeds. Next to her dead sister, until the voices went away. It was in the morning that the 18-year-old, despite having a broken hip, clawed herself to the top of the canyon. Then naked, wearing only a bra, she slumped at the side of the road until a car pulled up beside her. And she told them that she'd been beaten by two men and that they'd killed her sister. Mortified, the elderly couple looked over the railing, and sure enough, there was the 11-year-old child. All broken up on the rocks, her eyes still open, staring up at him. And despite Peggy's begging, they told her they'd have to leave her sister behind. Taking a blanket from his trunk, the old man wrapped up the young girl, who was freezing after being in the water all night, who was clearly in shock. Once they brought Becky into town, and she told the police what had happened, and that she'd been raped, her sister had been murdered by two greasy, filthy men, stinking alcohol. Well, it was a small town, so the cops knew. And shortly afterwards, they arrested 27-year-old Leroy Kennedy and 29-year-old Jerry Lee Jenkins. And by all accounts, the two hillbillies didn't even deny it. And in fact, they told cops that Becky was the best piece of ass that they'd ever had. Jeez, I guess some people are just born evil. During the trial, the two men mocked Becky and her family and showed zero remorse. And it took the jury less than 5 hours to hand down the death penalty to the two heartless killers. But unfortunately for Becky and many others who believe in justice, that death penalty was revoked in 1977. And the two stinky hillbillies were able to start applying for parole. A reality that would haunt Becky for the rest of her life. And sure, she tried to hide. Drug addiction, alcoholism, becoming a drifter, moving from state to state, hiding from those memories, from those scars. The guilt of her surviving while her sister didn't. Now those who knew Becky, who say that her life ending at that bridge, that was a natural conclusion, because she'd already died there 20 years earlier, after living a life of hell. And in the end, all she ever really wanted was to be with her sister again. And I guess she made that dream come true. It was on the afternoon of December 26th, 1900 and nothing. A small ship was making its way to a cluster of bleak rocks, known and still known as the Flannan Isles in the Outer Hebrides, where a lighthouse was located, a lighthouse erected to save many a ship from the abyss. It had only been 2 weeks earlier, just before midnight, that a ship had passed and almost crashed into her rocks, with the captain noting there was no light from the lighthouse to warn them. And as that light was never supposed to go dark, they sent out a ship to investigate. But due to the high seas, it would take them 2 weeks to get there. Once in the island's proximity, they fired a distress flare, and when that went unanswered, they sounded their horn. And when they saw no movement in the lighthouse, well, they instinctively knew that the following year, they'd be sending out less Christmas cards. What? It's true. It was then that four men prepared to go ashore and risk docking in the rough seas and their ship being smashed on the rocks, with all four of those men fearing what they may find on the tiny island. The lighthouse was manned by three lighthouse keepers, James Duquette, Thomas Marshall, and Donald MacArthur. As they landed on the island, there was a foreboding feeling amongst the men, unspoken, but they could see it in each other's faces. Climbing the stairs, uncertain what they were to find, as the captain opened the door, he realized that there was something terribly wrong. And he and a crew member made their way up the steep stairs to the kitchen, where the occupants of the tower would usually congregate. And as they walked into the kitchen, the first thing they saw was that the clock had stopped at 5 to 9 in the morning. A chair had been overturned and an unfinished meal on the table. And there was a canary in its cage, barely alive, almost starved to death. And the beds were made and appeared no one had slept in them. Built in 1899, the Flannan Lighthouse was erected because of the amount of ships that went down on her shores. Resting at the top of a 150-foot cliff, the lighthouse was designed to withstand the most treacherous of weather the North Atlantic had to offer, with often the ocean swallowing the small island and leaving only the tip of the lighthouse visible. The tower generated over 150,000 candle power. It flashed twice every 30 seconds and could be seen for 20 miles in either direction. Owned by the Northern Lighthouse Board in Edinburgh, Scotland, who were most concerned when the light went out. When word of the three disappearing lighthouse keepers hit the news, all of Scotland, or at least those who weren't drunk and having sex with a family member, were riveted by the tale. By maritime law, there always had to be one keeper inside of the tower. So while two of the keepers carried out their duties on the island, one always had to stay behind in the tower. And besides those keepers, the island was deserted. The isolation aside, the job wasn't a tough one. Working in 2-week shifts, the keepers' only responsibilities were to keep the lighthouse in good condition and running, cleaning the lens daily along with its mechanical parts and keeping their living quarters in clean condition. At the time of the three men's disappearance, there was no technology where there was radio contact with the shore. And every 2 weeks, a ship would arrive with replacement keepers and fresh supplies. And the last log to be entered into the logbook was the 15th of December. And there were no issues. The day was signed off without a problem. Now, with an investigation ensuing led by the Maritime Board to find out what had happened to the three men, ordered to turn over every rock on the island until they found an answer. It was a year later that they submitted their report. What had prompted those three men to leave the lighthouse in a hurry, all at the same time? Perhaps we'll never know. But investigators concluded that on the freezing day of December 15th, the waves were higher than usual, and ignoring common sense, all three of those men left that lighthouse. When the rescue boat arrived, the captain noted the ropes were uncoiled and draped down the side of the cliff. Ropes usually stored in a heavy wooden box and secured at the side of the crane. And bizarrely, the iron railings at the landing site were bent and twisted out of shape. And a large boulder weighing over a ton at the top of the cliff had been dislodged and had smashed down on the platform. Although all of this had to be surmised from a great distance because the waves were so high and the captain could only view the scene from atop of the cliff. In the report that was finally submitted to the Maritime Board in July of 1991, concluded that the three keepers had most likely left their post to go secure the large wooden box. And at this point, either the rock fell off the cliff and knocked them into the water, or a freak wave took them. Either way, it had the same results, and they were swept out to sea, never to be seen again. But critics of that report say that how could three experienced seamen be taken by a freak wave when it was their job to read those waves? And one of the seamen had left the lighthouse without his jacket and boots. They claim the wave took him on December 15th, the last entry in the log. But weather reports say the weather was clear and there wasn't a storm till the next day. And as per usual, why weren't the bodies washed back up on shore? And although the Maritime Board officially closed the case, Nobody was buying it. And 100 years later, it remains one of the maritime's great mysteries. I hope you filthy animals have enjoyed this podcast edition of One of My Joints.